Welcome to In the Hive, a show about the issues and ideas that tie Utah together. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program we'll feature some perspectives on water in Utah. How it's used, who uses it, and how it gets conserved, or, alternatively, wasted. And a good deal of today's show will focus on planned water infrastructure projects. There's a lot more to Utah's water picture, though, and so this is just the first in what we imagine will be an ongoing series on our water present and future. Not that long ago, I was digging through some old audio here at KCPW, and I came across a clip that kind of astounded me. Back in 2014, a producer here at the station interviewed Professor Dan McCool, who at the time was the head of the Environmental Studies program at the University of Utah. And in just over a minute's time, McCool succinctly described a kind of surprising reality about water in Utah.
People in Utah, what, there's about 3 million people now, in their homes use about 2 to 3% of all the water diverted and used in Utah. 2 to 3%. So when they say, oh my gosh, we're going to double the population, well, okay, that would be 6%. Still, only 6%. So we do not have a water shortage. We do not have a water crisis. We have a water management crisis. We're just misallocating water now. Almost all of that water, the lion's share of it, 80-some percent is used for agriculture. And the number one crop produced in Utah is hay. Much of that hay is exported to Asia. So when they say, well, we need more water to feed our families or to turn on the shower, that is fundamentally not true. We're just misallocating water to grow hay for people in Asia.
I have to admit that I was surprised when I heard that, because I had always assumed that it was the booming Utah population that was responsible for the bulk of our water use. Last week, I decided to track down Professor McCool, who I should say now is Professor Emeritus McCool, to hear a little more about the state of water and water conservation in Utah. And I asked him first if the picture he painted in this 1 minute of audio was still the paradigm in place today.
Yes, hasn't changed.
And then I asked him if there was a way to do something about that paradigm, or as McCool would have it, that misallocation of Utah water.
There is. And let me preface my set of solutions here by saying that I am absolutely not anti-agriculture. I eat, therefore I'm pro-agriculture, and everyone else should be too. However, water is a finite resource. We're not getting any more of it. But land, air, and water, they just don't make them like they used to. It's a zero-sum pie now. So it has to come from someplace. And there are other cities and regions of the American West that are truly water short, and they do have a water crisis. Las Vegas, Los Angeles, any city that's fundamentally dependent on the Colorado River is looking at a dire future. We do not have that problem on the Wasatch Front. We have a lot of surface water. Unlike all those other cities, we have a lot of good, high-quality surface water. So the only question is, what's the mechanism by which we retire agriculture and convert that into subdivisions? Now, do I want to see that happen? No. I think there's a finite carrying capacity for the land in terms of population, and I think 3 million people in a desert state is it. That anything beyond this, growth changes from an asset to a liability. But it's going to happen. I'm sorry, we're going to go to 6 million or 10 million or, you know, draw your insane number. Maybe when there's 20 million people in Utah, people will start to say, maybe growth isn't such a good thing, but it's gonna happen, and the water is going to come from agriculture because there's no place else to get it. We're not going to tow icebergs. We're not going to build a pipeline from the Yukon River or the Missouri River or the Great Lakes or any of the other outrageous ideas, because it costs a tiny, tiny fraction of that to pay a farmer, make him absolutely wealthy, retire his farm, return it to open space, and use that water for urban growth. That's what's going to happen. I'm not saying I like the idea, that it's my preference. It's just going to happen.
Is that system in place for that to happen right now, for a farmer to make money selling his water shares?
Only in a very limited extent. We are going to have dramatically expanded water marketing in the West, and we need that. If we're going to add another, there's 40 million people in the Colorado River Basin, 30 million, 35 million in California. The growth is exponential in some locations. It has to happen, but that needs to be part of a package of conservation policies, and Utah is way behind the curve on implementing and enforcing true conservation measures. Our idea of conservation is a mere shadow of what they're accomplishing in other locations. And the pricing of water is one way to do that. It should reflect its value. There should be a very steeply tiered pricing system where I believe there is such a thing as a human right to water. So a minimal amount of water to keep your family healthy.
It's just given out. It's just free.
Either free or a nominal charge. And if you're low income, one of the things they're doing in Chile is there's basically a water version of food stamps. So if you're really low income and you can't afford your water bill, they'll give you an affidavit to cover your water costs. Now, are we going to give out affidavits so people can sprinkle water on a half acre of bluegrass lawns? No, that would be absurd. That's not a human right. That's just waste.
And so that steep tiered pricing, essentially, if you're using more water, is what you're saying, you're going to be charged more per whatever that unit of water is.
Right. It's like for the first 1,000 gallons, it's the price of delivery. After that, it goes up and up and up and up, and it goes up steeply. If you look at the tiered system in the St. George area, they're tiny little baby steps. It goes from ultra low to slightly low. That's it. And then they claim they're running out of water. There's a whole host of ways to conserve water and use water more efficiently. Water marketing from agriculture is just one of the tools in the toolbox, but we have to do all of them. And we're not doing any of them efficiently now. And if we did all those things, there's absolutely no need to build the Bear River Project.
I'm going to take just a moment here to explain what the Bear River Project is. It's actually one of two big planned infrastructure projects to move water from one part of Utah to another, both of which are meant to fuel municipal growth. Again, that's water used by people in their homes. There's also the Lake Powell Pipeline, which we'll get to soon enough. But the Bear River Development Project would create a series of dams and pipelines on that river, and then move water from there to feed development along the Wasatch Front. It is estimated to cost somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion, and it would take water out of the river that is the major tributary for the Great Salt Lake.
Because of diversions of the sources for the Great Salt Lake, the lake's down 11 feet, and it'll go down another foot or maybe more if we build the Bear River Project. Now, a foot in a really shallow lake, that may not sound like much, that opens up huge expanses of dry lake bed. So the catastrophe in the making for this place is not running out of water like Las Vegas. It's drying up the Great Salt Lake. Just go to the Aral Sea in Russia and see what happens then. Go to the Owens Valley and Owens Lake. It's a disaster area.
Both of those examples McCool just mentioned are places where water was diverted from a terminal lake. The exposed dry lake beds led to dust storms and poor air quality. Part of the concern here is that for more than 100 years, the Great Salt Lake has been on the receiving end of mining tailings and other industrial waste.
the depository for all that windborne toxic material that's going to blow off that lake bed is going to come right onto the Wasatch Front, Ogden, Bountiful, Salt Lake. That's where it's going to end up. And there's mercury. There's all kinds of toxics. That's a bad stew of materials. You don't want to breathe that stuff. So drying up the Great Salt Lake just so we can overwater bluegrass lawns is by definition insanity. It's absolute insanity, especially when there's all these other tools we could use to conserve water and meet our reasonable growth needs without building any more diversions. What we really should be talking about now is reducing existing diversions to try to bring the lake back up. We need to restore the Great Salt Lake for our health. And of course, as everybody knows, we already have an air quality problem here. You dry up the Great Salt Lake, it becomes unbreathable.
Work on the Bear River project was initially going to kick off in 2015, but it has seen delays as water managers in Utah have pushed back the time they see an expected need. But it is still in the works, as is that other big project I mentioned, the Lake Powell Pipeline. It would take water from Lake Powell, the reservoir on the Utah-Arizona border where the Glen Canyon Dam reins in the Colorado River, and through a series of pipes would deliver that water to the rapidly growing Washington County and the county seat, St. George.
And that is right. The state legislature passed the Bear River Development Act in 1991. It passed the Lake Powell Pipeline Development Act in 2006 and also updated the Bear River Development Act in that same year.
That's Eric Millis. He's the director of the State Division of Water Resources.
Those two acts direct our division to develop those projects. And so we've been in the process of planning and assessing the need for those projects. The Lake Powell Pipeline project is ahead of the Bear River Development project by quite a few years, though we see that the Bear River Development project could be needed at some point in the future. And so we're trying to plan for and keep that project on the table in the event that it does become necessary.
I spoke with Millis and the division's deputy director, Todd Adams, earlier this week. When it comes to maintaining enough water in the Great Salt Lake to keep it and Utah residents healthy, Deputy Director Adams had this to say.
With the water that runs into the Great Salt Lake, you know, look at the last 20 years, we've been in quite a drought. Right? We've had a few good years. So a lot of that is based on what Mother Nature's providing. Is it important? Oh, you bet it's important. So we're watching and balancing that. And, you know, we're trying to find win-win-win-win-win solutions, if we can, to help balance those needs.
At the core of that clip I played at the beginning of this episode is the idea that big projects to move water from one place to another shouldn't be necessary because, as Professor McCool puts it, spending our water on hay to export to Asia is a misallocation. And so just by reallocating water, we should be able to supply our needs. But that had me wondering if there were any rules on preventing farmers from growing especially thirsty crops that use a lot of water. And that's a question I posed to state water managers. Again, here's Todd Adams, Deputy Director of the Division of Water Resources.
I don't believe that there's any rules. I would assume the bottom line helps them decide what they need and can do. You know, agricultural water use in the state of Utah is about 82%. We use the rest, you know, for our municipal and industrial and commercial and institutional needs. We have all sorts of ag optimization going on in making our agricultural products more efficient. You talk about shipping off alfalfa to China or wherever it's at, we ship it to. But, you know, I mean, the same thing can be said for semiconductors or whatever other products are out there. So that becomes an economy component. If somebody's willing to pay it, somebody's willing to sell it, buy it, that's what could happen. So that's a tough one. If a farmer pays too much for his product and developing his product and can't sell it for what he needs, then he's going to go out of business.
Again, that's Todd Adams, Deputy Director of the Division of Water Resources, talking about agricultural water use in Utah and the market drivers that guide the business of farming. There's no quick fix to moving water from, say, a hay farm to municipal use. But aside from the idea that Utah water is misallocated and that as a result the projects are unnecessary, Dan McCool has other concerns about proposed pipelines, which he says will lead to there being water winners and losers.
First of all, let's understand that dams and pipelines don't create water. Water's finite, all right? So when you build a pipeline, what it does is it takes water away from one group of people and gives it to another group of people. That's all it does. It doesn't create any new water, all right? So there's always a set of losers. For the Bear River Project, the losers is future growth in the Bear River. So people say, well, we need it for the Wasatch Front because there's going to be future growth. Well, there's going to be future growth in northern Utah as well, but that's too bad. We took their water. So all pipelines simply take water from somebody else. The Colorado River Basin is dramatically oversubscribed. Even the Bureau of Reclamation now admits there's a 2.5 million acre foot deficit, structural deficit. And all the prognoses regarding climate change and groundwater mining are that it's going to get a whole lot worse. Most predictions are that Lake Powell will go to Deadpool sometime this century. The only disagreement is how fast and when. Deadpool. The Lake Powell pipeline is going to take water out of a reservoir that's doomed.
So why does McCool say that Lake Powell is headed for Deadpool, meaning all but dry?
There's three things. First of all, upstream diversions. The upper basin states, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, are not using their full allocation. That's the only thing that's kept Los Angeles and Phoenix going lately. So they're going to divert more water. Now, Wyoming's talking about diversions. There's a proposal to divert water from Flaming Gorge and send it over to Denver. So upstream diversions, climate change, all the models predict a hotter, drier upper basin where the water comes from. All of them. There are no models that say things look really rosy up here. And the third one is the most recent studies indicate that we've been mining groundwater to a much greater extent. And when you pull down groundwater, it has a direct impact on river flows and surface water. So you put those three things together, and that means a dramatically reduced flow for the Colorado. Now, you add that to a fourth factor, which is when they negotiated the 1922 Water Compact, they misunderstood how much flow. They grossly overestimated it and based the entire 1922 Compact on a hydrological fallacy.
In case it wasn't obvious, the 1922 Colorado River Compact was the water-sharing agreement between states and Mexico for that river's water. I asked Eric Millis, Utah's Water Resources Director, about the available water on the river and about the notion that early water planners were basing their estimates on unusually wet years for the river.
So, yeah, the 1922 Compact was based on flow data that, you know, for the 20 or more years prior to that was very high. In fact, about the highest that's ever been seen, you know, for a long-term period ever on the river. And, of course, the compact was then made on that. The upper basin was to get 7.5 million acre feet, and the lower basin was to get 7.5 million acre feet, plus some tributary flow in the lower basin. And then there was water from Mexico that was accounted for that. And as we went from that point on, recognize that, whoa, those were wet years, and we don't have that water supply that the compact had been based on. You know, the compact allocates those amounts. We understand that we don't have that for the upper basin, and so our amount of 7.5 million acre feet, really based on reality, has been reduced to about 6.2 million acre feet. And so in the modeling that's done, you know, we're looking at current uses and current supply and all of those things to assess how much water there truly is available. And so the estimates and the numbers that we're using now for planning for Lake Powell Pipeline or for any other project in the upper basin is based on that lower figure. And we understand that the numbers will change again in the future, hopefully up, but they may in reality go down. But either way, we feel pretty good about the numbers, feel very good about the numbers, and that there will be water for that project.
Large-scale infrastructure projects are not the only arrows that Utah water managers say they have in their quiver. Here again is Eric Millis, echoing sentiments we heard earlier on converting the way water is used in the state.
Roger, there's a couple things that we see going on. One, I call anyway, the natural conversion of agricultural water to municipal and industrial use. And that's when, you know, farm fields that have been irrigated historically get bought up by a developer and built over with homes and businesses. That water that had been used for the irrigation previously could be and should be used to supply those new homes and businesses.
Water policy in the largely arid western United States is in some ways a legacy of 19th century water law that enshrines something called prior appropriation, basically a system of seniority for water rights. Here again is Professor Dan McCool with a sort of primer on that history.
The history is that the people who got here first in the American West developed a new system of water rights that met their needs. It's called prior appropriation. Made great sense at the time. Prior appropriation means that I get all of my water if I got here first, and in times of shortage, you get none. So if I have 5 acre feet and you have 2 acre feet, and the river usually runs at 7 acre feet, but this year it runs at 5, I get my entire 5, and you get nothing. I call it the to hell with you doctrine. The other aspect of that is if you don't use that water, you actually lose the water right. So there's a built incentive to not conserve water and use your entire allocation. That is precisely the opposite of the kind of water law we need under conditions of scarcity. So many of these water institutions and laws made sense when the West was sparsely populated, but they make no sense today, and we have to change them. We've also instituted a system of water conservancy districts and irrigation districts, and they've multiplied over the years, and each one has a bureaucracy and has to justify their existence, and they collect tax money and they want to build projects. That's what they do. And why did they have that mindset? Because that was a good idea 100 years ago. That's how you got water. You built a pipeline or a diversion or a dam. That does not make sense under conditions of water scarcity that we have today.
That scarcity is projected to be impacted by climate change as droughts become more frequent and longer in duration. At the same time, the population in the West is booming. So what's the state's plan for dealing with both growth and scarcity? We'll give the last word here to Utah Division of Water Resources Director Eric Millis.
I guess there's three components to how we see water needs for this growing population being met. One is, very importantly, water conservation, but then also the discussion that we just had with you about the ag to municipal water conversions, but then also water development projects. And the way I see this happening is that these things would happen concurrently, and that when we start talking about projects, we would have numerous small projects throughout the state, punctuated by a couple of big ones anyway, like the Lake Powell Pipeline or the Bear River Development Project. And so we see those things working hand in hand and all very necessary parts of ensuring that there is water for the future.
All day I've faced a barren waste without the taste of water.
At the top of the show, I said that this was the first in what we hoped will be a series on water planning and use. There's a lot we didn't get into today, including how pricing water to better promote conservation might work. I'm also planning to get the perspective of farmers who are growing some of those water-intensive crops like alfalfa hay, and from municipal water departments. In short, I'm only beginning to learn this stuff myself, so stay tuned. And please weigh in with your own thoughts on what needs covering. Send an email to comments@kcpw.org. That's it for In the Hive today. Our theme music, which you heard at the top of the show, is by Andrew Shaw. Right now you're listening to a group from the 1940s called the Sons of the Pioneers. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll be with us again next week.
Carry on to water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water. Cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water, cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? Dan's feet are sore, he's yearning for just one thing more than water. Cool water. Like me, I guess he'd like to rest.